Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
This is my last day at Marketplace. After almost 11 years, first as the overnight host and now on this show, I believe I've worked here long enough to understand this place, and I can honestly say that never has economic news been more toxic.
Wake up to the day's top business headlines. Subscribe to the Marketplace Morning Report podcast. It's on iTunes and marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace podcast for Wednesday, the 14th of March. And first of all, I'm kidding. I'm not leaving. Come on. Second of all, if I were, though, what a way to go out. A guy named Greg Smith, who until today worked at Goldman Sachs, did the print equivalent of the same thing this morning, quit very publicly, blasting his former employer in the process. In an op-ed in the New York Times, Smith said, among other things, that Goldman is toxic and destructive, that it puts profits ahead of clients. You get the picture. Pretty much burned those bridges right down. We're going to take a minute now and dissect what Smith said and how true it might or might not be with Barry Ritholtz. He's the CEO at Fusion IQ. It's a research firm in New York City. Also, Josh Brown of Fusion Analytics. He's a regular on our morning show. Guys, it's good to have you with us.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
So, Josh, I heard you on the morning report this morning with Jeremy Hobson talking about this thing. And you basically said, you know what? This is the Wall Street culture. Get over it. Really?
Yeah, really. I think the op-ed itself was a little bit inflamed and overly dramatic. I think the vast majority of people that work at Goldman Sachs are good people who are trying to do the best they can. It's not necessarily a culture where they want to rip everyone's throats out.
Barry, what's your sense?
I take a little longer view and remember the days when, first of all, it's not just Goldman Sachs. It's Goldman, mm-hmm. it's Merrill, it's
right.
Morgan, UBS. It's all the big shops. And second, the change that really dramatically altered the cultures took place when they went from partnerships to publicly traded companies. And once you're a public firm, well, guess what? The number for the quarter drives everything else into a secondary position. Got to make your revenue numbers, got to hit your earnings, go, 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 whatever you got to do. And that's how you end up with a culture that places a high value on ripping the client's eyeballs out.
Josh Brown, let me pick up on that, not that image, but that idea. Isn't it in a firm's best interest to take care of its clients? And doesn't that give lie to the whole Goldman ethos?
Yes, and I think it's important that we don't talk about Goldman like it's a monolithic firm right. and they're only in one line of business.
Right.
It's not like Ford where they just make cars. Goldman's got areas of the business where it's very important that they execute and take care of their clients. But then there are other parts of the firm where they're moving and shaking with assets that are going from one balance sheet to the next, and they're trading as a principal against their actual clients.
Yeah. Josh, let me ask you to give Barry a poke in the eye here for a second and ask you if what he's saying isn't a little bit of false romanticism, right? He wrote this morning about how, you know, these guys used to tell great stories and it's camaraderie and mentoring and,
right.
and taking care of each other.
Well, I still think that exists today. I think that you had a culture where there was a lot more training and mentorship, but even still, that mentoring was mentoring people to come in to their own and become killers.
There's a whole lot of, I'm shocked to find out this happens on Wall Street in the press today. None of this is new, man. I mean, you go back to Michael Lewis and Solomon Brothers and You're So Stupid You Could Be a Client. I mean, this has been around
forever. That's the point that I'm trying to make. It's not like Wall Street was the Girl Scouts and then all of a sudden a switch was flipped. You can go back even further than Michael Lewis in the 80s and the 70s. You can go back 100 some odd years. Anyone could get fleeced at any time. So to say that all of a sudden the culture's changed is a little bit naive and a little bit childish. And that's the part of Greg Smith's op-ed that I took exception with.
Barry, you know, the regular person on the street who is 3 years out of a financial crisis that almost sank the whole economy and will read probably the first two paragraphs of Greg Smith's op-ed, if that. What are they supposed to make of Wall Street now?
Well, you know, it's funny because I've been a vociferous critic of Wall Street, and I find myself in the unusual situation of defending some of what the street does that's right. And, you know, if we're going to use Goldman as an example, they used to call it, we're long-term greedy. We want to be greedy, but over a period of decades, and grow as the clients become wealthy.
Hey, Kai, I have an ironclad law of financial products.
All right.
Brown's Law of Financial Products states that the more you're compensated as the broker to sell something,
yeah.
the worse it is for the client.
Barry, what about that?
remember the great scene in A League of Their Own where he says, this is a simple game. You hit the ball, you catch the ball, you throw the ball. Well, Wall Street should be similar. You buy good companies with strong growth and good earnings. You buy high-quality bonds with a nice dividend and little risk. And you allow time to compound over long periods.
Yes, but it's way sexier if you don't do that.
Josh Brown, he's at Fusion Analytics. He blogs at The Reform Broker, and he's a regular on our Wednesday morning report with Jeremy Hobson. Barry Ritholtz blogs at The Big Picture. He's the CEO at Fusion IQ. Guys, thanks a lot.
Bye-bye.
Our pleasure.
Shares of Goldman got smacked today, as you might imagine. The major indices, though, didn't really move much. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. America's 19 biggest banks, and I appreciate the irony here given the previous interview, but 19 biggest banks in this country are now officially stress-free, at least the 15 that passed the Federal Reserve's inspection, results of which were announced yesterday. Did wonders for the stock market to know that banks are healthy enough to weather a hypothetical financial storm. But as we've said ad infinitum on this program, the Dow Industrials are not the economy. So what did the passing grades really mean? Here's our senior business correspondent, Bob Moon.
One columnist suggested today the stress test results might clear the way for more business investment and, by implication, more hiring. The theory being companies might worry less about their credit lines being cut off again should the economy go south. At Moody's Analytics, chief economist Mark Zandi says it'll also take more demand for goods and services to restore business confidence. But at least the stress test set the stage for that to happen.
We need a banking system that's on solid ground, and I think we've got it. And that means that banks will extend credit and credit will be able to power economic growth going forward. So it's a necessary condition for a good economy.
At Brown University, economist David Weiss agrees the banks are in a better position to nurture the economic recovery.
It means that the bank should be a little more willing to lend you money to buy the new car or even to buy a new house.
But the question is, will you, your neighbor, or the boss be in the market to borrow more money? As we've heard month after month, much of that depends on consumer confidence, and the Federal Reserve is clearly hoping that the upbeat stress test results will restore that faith.
From my perspective, this stress test is for real.
Mark Zandi at Moody's says the results of this hypothetical deep downturn suggest consumers and investors should be reassured. This is what he's been telling his clients today.
If our banking system can digest this, and it could pretty much digest anything and is up to the task of extending the credit needed for the economy to continue to grow.
In other words, now the banks are healthy, they're ready to nurse the rest of us with credit, what Zandi calls the mother's milk of economic activity. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
The South by Southwest Festival in Austin, Texas, has turned over from technology to movies and music for the rest of the week. The clubs and cafes on 6th Street down in Austin are going to be jammed, I'm sure. And when the partying finally ends, all those people are going to need a place to rest their weary heads. And that's what homeowners near downtown are calling a business opportunity. Kate Archer-Kent of Red River Radio reports.
It's an enviable problem. Hundreds of thousands of people descend on your city. And where will they all bunk up? We asked some South by Southwest attendees.
My name is Thiago Ritter. I'm from Brazil. I rented this apartment from a friend of a friend.
Tara Burkowski from Long Island. I'm staying at the W Hotel. The W Hotel costs about $700 a night.
My name's Emma Feigenbaum. I'm from New York. I'm staying at Airbnb. I think it's about $150 a night, which is a deal around here.
You heard Emma just say Airbnb. It's one of the numerous websites used by Austin homeowners to rent out their homes, and they're definitely cashing in on South by Southwest. It's perfectly legal to do, by the way. 27-year-old Amon Jane owns a three-bedroom home. He negotiated $6,000 for a week's rent, and that will cover about two mortgage payments. Jane says he handed over the keys without trepidation.
We went through the house rules and told them about all the good restaurants, where to get the best margaritas. And I mean, it's definitely a risk, but we have all our neighbors watching them.
It just so happens that one of the biggest home rental companies is based in Austin. It's called Home Away. Spokesman Victor Wang says an average rental goes for $200 per night, but a Super Bowl-type event can quickly drive up the market.
Similar to hotels, during big events like South by Southwest, you know, the prices do go up. And the prices are generally dictated by, you know, supply and demand and also what other homeowners are listing their homes in the surrounding areas.
The Janes work from home. They loaded up their car with their computers, a lovebird, and a box of family photos. Now they're back in Shreveport, Louisiana, both sleeping in their childhood bedrooms at peace.
The most important thing to us was what happens if they burn down our house. And so we called our insurance company, and surprising to us, this is actually something that they cover.
South by Southwest organizers say the room shortages are an ongoing problem, but several new hotels are being built. Meanwhile, the Janes are eager to rent out their place again. I'm Kate Archer-Kent for Marketplace.
Assuming 3.5 or 4 something a gallon gas doesn't dissuade you from driving entirely, anybody who relies on a car to get around inevitably encounters another problem. Where to park the thing? In their most common forms, parking lots are a gazillion square feet of asphalt next to sports stadiums or shopping malls or wherever, frankly, you happen to find yourself. But whatever they look like, parking lots aren't usually much more than an afterthought for drivers. Not so, though, for Eran Ben-Joseph. He's a professor in urban design at MIT, and he's also the author of the new book, Rethinking a Lot, as in parking lot. When we talked the other day, we started with a bit of history.
The first one were really curb parking, because people would just actually would leave their car in the middle of the street and just go do their business. There were no rules. So it's actually an interesting story even about L.A., where in the 1920s, the city actually wanted to ban parking in the downtown, because at that time, most people actually came with trolleys.
Right. No, exactly. Yeah.
And the hidden secret of Los Angeles. Actually, when they did that, the ban lasted maybe only about 2 weeks, because the merchants were complaining that there's not enough parking to attract the shoppers. Mm. So, parking lot were actually done in many cases in downtown for that. And also, the shopping mall itself, in terms of actually providing the free parking as a model in the 1930s.
So when I look at a parking lot, I see, at best a parking lot. You, though, you see it differently.
I do. I see a big potential in parking lots. I mean, if you look, we are right here in L.A., and there's a lot of empty parking lots. In terms of sometimes they have cars, sometimes they don't have cars.
Right.
Can we do something with those parking lots? Can people play basketball there? Can they be markets during the weekend? So there's a lot of potential in those empty spaces. You know, I do teach a course that is called site planning, and part of the course, it is about designing parking lots. And every time the students have been asking me, aren't there actually some great examples of parking lot and that you can show us?
So what's your favorite all-time parking lot?
It's a tough question. And in terms of design, probably the one in the was done by Renzo Piano in Italy.
I mean, he's a well-known architect.
Yes. It's totally covered with trees like an orchard. Then you move from the parking lot. There's very much of well-organized entrances to the building onto this large old Fiat factory. So again, the kind of more issue of moving through the space as you enter the building. I always like to, again, with my students, give a comparison. And if you go to a resort hotel, let's say in Hawaii, they won't already tell you as you enter the parking lot that you're in a different place. Yeah. And it's not about having an ugly parking lot and the hotel be beautiful. It's already when you enter the parking lot. What I hope that this kind of attitude would also go into shopping malls and into other types of parking lot that are more, kind of mundane and typical.
I see the point, right? I mean, I get that. But the problem is that for so many of us, much as the car is a utilitarian device, so too the place to put the car is just a utilitarian device. And so we haven't got much time or patience for, let's make it look pretty and nice and functional.
Yeah, but it also has other qualities in the parking lot that could be useful. So even if you just want to find your parking space and move into the building, can the space itself be a multipurpose space that can do for society more than just a place for storing your car for a few hours?
Yeah. Eran Ben-Joseph, his book is called Rethinking a Lot. Thanks a lot for coming in.
Thank you so much. I enjoyed it.
Coming up, from bottom, literally, to $1 billion.
Well, I was actually unhappy with the way my rear end looked in white pants, Kai. I just got to call a spade a spade.
Sarah Blakely, the founder of Spanx. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials added 16 points today, about a 10%, closed at 13,194. The NASDAQ edged up a fraction, less than a point, finished at 3,040. The S&P 500 ditched a point. That's a 10%, ended things at 1394. A day after the Fed released results of its stress test on the big banks, it was mostly a good day for the winner. Shares of Regions Financial surged nearly 7%. Bank of America took in more than 4% today. American Express reeled in 3.5%. Somewhat different story, though, for those that didn't pass. MetLife deflated nearly 6%. Citigroup sagged almost 3.5%. Goldman Sachs passed the test only to get that Dear John letter we told you about. Shares at the investment bank dropped 3.3%. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.27%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Labor Department releases the Producer Price Index for February. A Senate Banking, Housing, and Urban Affairs subcommittee discusses strengthening the housing market and minimizing losses to taxpayers. And a classic returns to Broadway. Arthur Miller's Death of a Salesman opens with Philip Seymour Hoffman starring. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. As Rick Santorum basks in the glow of his wins in Alabama and Mississippi last night, and Mitt Romney focuses on the actual delegate count, voters have their own things that they're worried about. And we've been asking what they might be this week for our election coverage, the real economy. Today, Beth Kelly. She helps companies fill empty job openings, which isn't always as easy as it sounds.
I'm a human resources professional in Michigan. I help small and medium-sized businesses find qualified employees, and I've got a front-row seat to the widening skills gap. Most employers are ready to hire, but they can't find the talent they need. You wouldn't think that would be the case in Michigan. Unemployment is still 9% here. But it is, and this skills gap is worrying business leaders who want to grow their companies and create jobs. There's a combination of factors pushing this gap even wider. First, skill requirements, especially in manufacturing, have risen so much in the last couple years that it's hard enough to keep up to date when you're working every day, let alone when you're unemployed. Second, a lot of Michigan's talent moved on to other states when jobs disappeared here, and it's a challenge to recruit people back, especially given the state's reputation. Michigan's economy is coming back, though, and we're trying different things to fill the skills gap. Community colleges have developed some innovative training programs, and some church groups are offering transitional services and counseling for those who are out of work. Still, we could use some help from our policymakers. Unfortunately, the chronically unemployed face a stigma in the workplace, and technology advancements of the past few years may have passed them by. Instead of extending unemployment benefits, let's reinvest those dollars into worker retraining programs that build skills, confidence, and work ethic. We also need to improve our talent supply chain, starting at early childhood. As an employer, I need to know that the high school graduate I hire is capable of applied math, reading, writing, and problem solving. Our economic survival hinges on fixing our very broken public education system. I believe we're on the cusp of another economic expansion, and that the biggest constraint we have right now is human capital. Filling the skills gap is the most important issue for me this election year.
Beth Kelly is the president of ConnectSource. That's a human resources company in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Take a second. Let us know what you want out of this election. Go to marketplace.org, click on contact. I mentioned Sarah Blakely on the broadcast the other day in the context of her being the youngest self-made woman, she's 41, on the Forbes billionaires list. She got there with the company she founded, Spanx, which, to be honest, I'd never heard of until about a month ago. But the Spanx story is pretty good. So we made some phone calls. And today on Conversations from the Corner Office, here she is. Sarah Blakely, it's good to have you with us.
Great to be here.
First things first, we should probably say Spanx is not just one thing. It's a product line of hundreds of items, right?
It is, yes. We actually have 200 body-shaping, body-transforming products.
Well, okay, so I was going to save this till the end, but since you brought it up, I got in some trouble the other day for calling Spanx a girdle. listeners went bananas.
Really?
Oh, yeah. They were like, no, they're not girdles. So now that I've got you here, let me hear it from the horse's mouth. Girdle, not girdle.
Definitely not a girdle. I mean,
really?
Well, let me tell you, because girdles have such a negative connotation. Well, they've been uncomfortable. And so what Spanx did was fill this little niche of undergarments for women that was so long overdue. And I took pantyhose material because it's so thin and second to skin and used that to create shapewear.
So mea culpa then to everybody who yelled at me. You were right and I was wrong. There's, you know, the story of you founding this company is pretty well known. I mean, you were a fax saleswoman, right? Unhappy with your pantyhose and you basically cut the feet off and went from there.
Well, I was actually unhappy with the way my rear end looked in white pants, Kai. I just got to call a spade a spade.
All right.
Yeah, I was frustrated. I had these white pants I'd spent a lot of money on. And you get home and you think, what am I really supposed to wear under this? So it was a frustrated consumer moment. I had $5,000 in savings. And I went on the internet and was like, I got to figure out how to keep these comfortably just below the knee because they smoothed me out and made me look firmer and toner and no panty lines.
How did you get, though, from that $5,000 to a billion-dollar company, by a lot of estimates, with no debt, no outside investors, and without really having to spend a whole lot on advertising? How'd you do that?
I didn't know better, Kai. I went to Barnes & Noble and bought a book on patents and wrote my own patent. I trademarked the name Spanx online for $150 with my credit card, and I sent them to Oprah as a gift, and then I cold called Neiman Marcus, and it organically grew.
Let me ask you the entrepreneurial question, though. How did you know? When did you know? Because you are the founder, not the CEO of this company. How did you know enough to get out of your own way and hire a real CEO?
It's a great question. I had to be every department when I started. I was the packer, the shipper, the before and after butt shot model. I mean, I was everything.
Hey now, it's a family
I show. Learned very quickly what I liked to do, what I didn't like to do, and what I was good at and what I wasn't good at. And as soon as I could afford to hire my weaknesses, I did.
Dude, that was a great line. You hire your weaknesses.
Yeah. I mean, I always encourage people, as soon as you can afford to do it, do it.
Yeah. So I was at a big fancy education gala thing this past weekend, fundraiser, and I didn't actually ask around, but had I, my guess would have been that some sizable proportion of the women there were wearing Spanx. And the question that comes out of that is, have you made it okay now for women to talk about this and to actually wear this kind of shapewear?
Well, I think women like Gwyneth Paltrow and Beyonce Jessica Alba have.
All right, wait a minute. Gwyneth Paltrow and Beyonce, none of those women need Spanx, right?
Well, listen, every woman who doesn't want a panty lying or a thong showing, it likes Spanx. I mean, it used to be shapewear. Nobody would ever talk about it. It is so crazy now, Kai, because everywhere I go, I get flashed. My husband's like,
flashed?
I get flashed. Wow. I mean, he didn't believe it until we started dating. And he's like, God, everywhere you go, women are flashing you their chest, their rear end. They're lifting up their skirts at cocktail parties. And
all right, you know what? That's a little weird.
Well, they're just so excited to show me or to tell me what they want. You know, that's how I get all my good ideas.
Okay, enough about you. What about me? When are you going to have something for men that I can wear that I'm not afraid to talk about?
Kai, we have men's now. What we decided to do was reinvent the undershirt. And we just decided to narrow it in at the waistline so it looks much cleaner under suits and dress shirts.
Now, you have men's briefs, right? And there's a certain compression issue there that sounds troubling.
Well, all we did was reinvent the pouch. The men that wear it and test fit it all said that it was very, very comfortable and it kept the family together.
Kept the family. All right.
I didn't know that was an issue.
Not that you need to, but as you think about expanding, which obviously you are you thinking at all about taking this firm public?
You know, I never, ever was open to it until recently. And recently I just started saying, you know, I feel open to the possibility of either something like that or bringing in possibly an outside investor. Where we are right now and the growth we want to have internationally and opening Spanx retail standalone stores, it's going to require a significant amount of investment. But up until now, I was like, no, never, never. But now I'm saying never say never.
Sarah Blakely, she's the founder of Spanx. Sarah, thanks a lot.
Thanks so much, Kai. And I'm going to send you the Spanx for men, okay?
All right. And I will, you know what? So I'll try them, but I'm not going to tell anybody about it.
All right. Got a deal.
There's more of my conversation with Sarah Blakely. Power panties, bra cha-chas, the whole smash. Can't believe I'm saying that on the radio. It's on our website, marketplace.org.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
We pause on the way out today to remember Encyclopedia Britannica, the paper version of which was killed off by its publisher yesterday at the tender age of 244.
I remember going to a library and just closing my eyes and picking one out.
I think we got them through a receipt offer at the grocery store.
I don't remember what it was like to get a new car. I always lived in the same house, but when we got new encyclopedias, it was such a big deal.
And just going through it, whatever letter it was.
Look up dinosaurs and...
to see that you could read an entry on baboons, maybe for something in school, and then right after that is an entry on, like, balloons. You just keep reading that.
Play around with the encyclopedia.
Poring over the pages, like, just browsing and looking.
Page through it. Texture of the paper.
It'll be weird to not have that tactile sort of, you know, intimacy with the knowledge you're soaking up.
I'm really interested to see if my son pours over an iPad the same way that I poured over an encyclopedia.
From the Marketplace crew, that was Angela Kim, Ben Adair, Betsy Streisand, Desiree Pena, Eve Tro, Mary Doe, and John Haas. All right, we got to go. That's Marketplace from APM. Today, the Dow added 16 points at 13,194. The NASDAQ edged up a fraction, 3,040. The S&P 500 gave back a point, a 10%, 1,394. Robbie Carman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Bradford Craig, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, and Brendan Willard engineered the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us again tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.